Hello, and welcome back to Current Account. I'm your host, Clay Lowry, the Executive Vice President here at the Institute of International Finance. On Current Account, I try to talk about what I see as the most important current issues in international finance and economics, while providing my own U.S. politics and policy angle on these different issues when it is relevant. On this week's Current Account, I'm going to talk about the banking turmoil that occurred roughly 1 year ago today. To understand better what actually happened on that day, we actually covered this in Current Account number 38 in March of last year. But just for a quick summary, on March 8th, 1 year ago, Silicon Valley Bank, an institution that is supervised by the Federal Reserve Bank here in the United States, and a bank with over $200 billion in assets at the time, announced that they had a substantial loss as they sold their securities. Now, why that was important was when they sold their securities, they had to mark to market those securities. In other words, they had to basically discount them downward because when they had bought them, interest rates had not yet risen. When interest rates rose, the price of those securities went down. So their hope at the time was they would sell these securities and they would also raise another $2 billion in equity, as well as also try to issue some debt. The market reaction to this was quite negative, actually. On March 9th, in fact, over $40 billion in deposits left Silicon Valley Bank in just that day alone. And on March 10th, so less than 2 days after saying that they were going to be selling their securities, Silicon Valley Bank had failed and, at the time, became the second largest bank failure in the history of the United States. 2 days later, March 12th, Signature Bank was also closed by regulators, becoming, at the time, the third largest bank failure in the history of the United States. Now things got kind of exciting because less than 1 week later, Credit Suisse out of Switzerland and one of the largest financial institutions in the world and what is known as a systemically important financial institution became the first SIFI to actually fail. Now their failure was facilitated in a sale to its rival UBS by the Swiss regulators. Less than 2 months later, in May, First Republic Bank also failed. By the way, because of the size of First Republic Bank, they became the second largest bank failure in the United States, therefore moving Silicon Valley Bank to being the third and Signature Bank being the fourth. Why did all this happen? And why did this clear banking turmoil not become a banking crisis? I think there's a number of reasons for that. First is the swift and decisive action that the U.S. and the Swiss financial authorities took to help basically put Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank into liquidation, to put Credit Suisse into a sale, and to put First Republic Bank also into liquidation and to sell it as well. Second was probably the overall health of the banking system. In the United States and in Switzerland, as well as in Europe and other parts of the world, the banking system had been overhauled following the global financial crisis in 2008-2009. And a lot of the regulations that had been enhanced over that time period, in some respects, probably worked and actually helped create a wall around financial institutions that they were not like the banks that were failing. And then partially, it is probably due to just unique aspects of these specific institutions. So let's try to talk about what those unique aspects are, because it kind of tries to tie into here we are a year later. What did we learn and what should we think about going forward? Since the collapse of these institutions, there have been numerous reports written by official regulators, whether it's in the United States by the Fed, the FDIC, the Inspector General at the Fed, or in Switzerland by their regulator, FINMA. There's also been reports written by the standard setters, such as the Basel Committee, sometimes known as the BCBS, the Financial Stability Board, the International Association of Deposit Insurers, and the International Monetary Fund. There's also been a number of non-governmental actors that have also provided their thoughts on the issue. And all of these different institutions and actors have tried to figure out lessons learned, what actually happened. And they've come up with different ideas, but they kind of seem to circulate around the following. there were governance issues at most of these institutions. And what I mean by that is they had governance issues as in either they were taking risks that they didn't really understand. So they were not paying attention to what is called interest rate risk. Interest rate risk is basically you borrow when interest rates are lower, interest rates rise, and then you need to sell your asset and it's worth less because your interest rates have risen against it. This is a common financial banking issue, but it seemed like these institutions had not taken it as seriously. There was liquidity risk, which is risk that depositors would run. Now, the way you try to solve this, at least in the United States, is through deposit insurance. However, there was a high percent of uninsured deposits at a number of these financial institutions. There was probably business model risk. A couple of these institutions had grown at a tremendous clip over a very short period of time. And so the risk management procedures had not kept up with the size and growth of these institutions. And so in some respects, it was just inadequate risk management for a business model that had been adopted. And there were other issues as well that maybe are more specific, such as Silicon Valley Bank seemed to have a very concentrated deposit base. So you had a lot of deposits, but from very few core members. And there seemed to be the idea that is there risk that comes out of the fact that information in the digital age moves a lot faster than it used to be the case. And so a deposit run can be triggered by a Twitter account as opposed to by people reading things in the newspaper. A secondary issue in the governance standpoint was around supervision. Now, this is actually much more on the official sector than it is necessarily on the private sector. So what a number of the analysts have looked at over the time is whether or not was there enough attention being paid, particularly in the United States, more so than Switzerland, on the effectiveness and implementation of what the supervisors do. Now, this is an important concept that sometimes is mixed up, which is there is regulation, which are the rules that a financial institution needs to live by. So their regulators check those rules to make sure that banks are living up to them. But they also supervise those institutions and they look and see, is the business model make sense? Are they following the rules that they're supposed to be? So in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, their capital standards and their liquidity standards were within the regulations. In fact, actually, they were above the regulations. But the supervision of those institutions didn't seem to take into account, or if it took into account, it was not enforced. So the effectiveness of the supervision seemed to be low. Some people have pointed out that maybe the regulation was not adequate enough. So that gets you into the concepts of capital and liquidity. Although some of the analysis that we have seen suggests that maybe this actually is less of the case, at least in the United States case and in the Credit Suisse case in Switzerland. So as we come to this 1 year anniversary and this banking crisis turns out not to have been a crisis, it turns out to be turmoil. It then makes you consider what should be the tools that are used, particularly by the public sector, but to some extent by the private sector, on trying to make sure we prevent this from happening in the future, or at least we can identify these risks better so maybe that we can prevent it. And so those questions probably lead you towards a few answers. One is kind of the standard playbook for, I think, regulators, which is to think about capital and liquidity. So, and what I mean by that is, do financial institutions need to raise more capital, which basically means they issue equity for when they provide their financing, as opposed to providing debt or getting deposits? Or do they need to figure out, do they have to have tougher liquidity standards? That means basically being able to pay off their bills almost on a real-time basis. Those are the typical answers which quantitative measures can be done against, but there's probably a fair amount of non-quantitative measures that are being looked at. And that is the role of deposit insurance itself, particularly in the United States, as I mentioned. The role of supervision. How do you make it more efficient and effective? Now, there is no quantitative measure for this. You just basically, it's something that has to be done, and the regulators themselves will be in charge of it. The role of governance and culture. So, how do you measure culture and how do you measure governance? And is there a way to have a prophylactic against a bad culture or a problem on governance? So we hear that Credit Suisse, by its supervisors, by its competitors, had been in trouble from a culture and governance standpoint for a number of years prior to its collapse. Is there a way to prevent that? Is there a way to come forward and find mechanisms that allow for better governance at both the private sector side, but to some extent, the public sector side? All of this comes back to a very important issue, which is the idea of learning from our mistakes. So in some respects, we showed during this turmoil, not crisis, and I keep saying that, is that learning from mistakes, for instance, the Federal Reserve and the FDIC in the United States and the Swiss banking authorities took immediate and robust action to try to resolve problems right away. In many respects, this is lessons that were learned over different financial crises we've seen, not just during the global financial crisis in the United States and Europe, but going all the way back to the crisis that happened in the banking system in Japan back in the 1990s, which is resolve the problems as quickly as you can. You're going to make mistakes, but deal with them fast. All right, those were lessons that were learned. Today, are there some other lessons? And so that's the thing. And can we learn from those mistakes and make changes? If we fall into the routine toolbox of just thinking about, let's look at liquidity, let's look at capital, and let's move on, then I think that that would be a mistake. And so I think some of these other issues, which I've tried to mention in this podcast, are worth considering. We know that the financial system right now in the United States is actually in pretty healthy shape. However, there are institutions that do have some problems. We do hear about fairly often here in the United States, is commercial real estate going to be a problem for specific banks or for the system as a whole? I think right now it doesn't appear to be, but let's make sure. And are there steps that should be taken, whether it is in areas such as culture, such as in governance, resolution authority, better supervision, the deposit insurance system, that will help us so that we do not run into the problems that we saw from Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, First Republic Bank, and Credit Suisse going forward? Now it's time for my 3-2-1. That's my three main takeaways, two things I'm looking forward to, and my one sports fact. The three main takeaways from the incidents that happened last year, starting with Silicon Valley Bank, are that one, the banking system as a whole in both the United States and Europe was able to withstand the blows of the collapse of the second, third, and fourth largest collapses in the history of the United States, as well as the G-SIFI coming out of Switzerland. Second, there clearly are lessons that have been learned in terms of weaknesses in supervision, weaknesses in governance, and weaknesses in risk management. And third, the tool chest to try to deal with these problems is still being worked on by policymakers, regulators, and to a certain extent, the private sector. But it's still a work in progress. So here are my two things I'm looking forward to. The first is not directly related to the Silicon Valley Bank and other banking turmoil that we saw, which is, where is the Federal Reserve going to go with the Basel III endgame? Basel III endgame was the idea of putting in place capital standards that would make the system much more resilient while still remaining innovative and creative as a system. Chairman Powell has recently said in congressional testimony that major revisions may be needed. We're going to find out over the next few months what happens there. And next, on the areas that I tried to mention at the end, areas that are a little bit different than quantitative measures, are the regulators and supervisors and policymakers going to take these up and try to make changes to the system that would hopefully make it more resilient going forward? And now my one sports fact. This year, Paris is going to host the Summer Olympics. I think this is relevant because in 1900, when Paris also held the Summer Olympics, it was the first time that sailing had ever come into the Olympics as an Olympic sport. I know absolutely nothing about sailing. but it is fun to see people having fun with it. And there will be 10 events in Paris this summer. So it has been an Olympic sport for 124 years. And we'll see going forward in Paris how things happen. And I raise all of this because sometimes people think of sailing as just a recreational activity. But in fact, of course, it is a competition, as the Olympics proves. And earlier this month, a 29-year-old woman from the United States, Cole Brower, became the first woman to race nonstop around the world in a sailboat. She completed her 30,000-mile journey after 130 days, placing second, and as the only woman in a 16-person global solo challenge. Now, what did she do? She and her competitors started in Spain. They sailed down the west coast of Africa. They went over to Australia, around the tip of South America, before they returned back to Spain. You can just imagine how dangerous this must be, including going through the three great capes of Africa, Australia, and South America. South America's Cape Horn, for instance, has the wonders of sailing through a combination of whipping winds, frigid water, and stray icebergs. That must be interesting. And Brower herself overcame a broken rib in a deteriorating boat when she joined a group of fewer than 200 people in the world who have ever sailed solo around the world. Brower is 5'2", and she was the youngest competitor in the competition. I think her size doesn't mean much because she showed through her determination, her grit, and her perseverance, and her love for the sport that she could overcome these odds. And to finish second is pretty incredible. Well, anyway, that's going to wrap up this episode of Current Account. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback on the show as we constantly look to improve and enhance the experience for you, the listener. We can be reached at podcast@iif.com. All our episodes can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.